we've all heard of data security. Maybe people have heard of decentralization. What are like those core things that you care about, you know, personally, and that OKTurtles stands for?
At the moment, I'm focusing on technology that can take power away from the centers of big tech and redistribute it back into the hands of the people while protecting their privacy and security.
Have you heard of the inshittification cycle?
Of course.
Can you tell us about what is the inshittification cycle?
Initially, there is a group of people who are making an amazing product, and then they go and they market it to both users and venture capital. They're like, look at this amazing thing that we've created. And venture capital is like, oh, that's a fancy toy you have there for attracting, souls into.
Here's trapping some souls.
Yeah, we're trapping some souls into. This is some nice bait we can kind of toss out into the ocean of souls. So here's some money and, you know, go ahead and market it some more and get as many people as you can, basically. And then comes the next step where they're successful in that and they do manage to get millions and millions of users on board. But then that's where they start reeling the users back in. That's where the VCs are like, okay, now we're going to start making money on our investment, right? And then that's where they start making choices that are in the interest of profit over the interest of the users. And many times, and this isn't always the case, there are some good VCs out there. They're hard to find, but there are some. The choices that some of the not so good VCs end up making is they will have the company focus less and less on things that are actually critically important to the privacy and security of their customers and are simply things that the company can do quickly in the short term to grab a whole lot of money. And those choices and decisions aren't always in the best interest of users. And for that reason, you have this inshittification cycle.
And you're currently developing software, right? That's something that you do. You're working on Group Income. You're creating Chelonia. How are you not going to get into the inshittification cycle? Or is that a fear of yours?
What we've done is we've created a nonprofit right now that's stewarding all of this work. And we are making sure that the core foundation that we're building, like Chelonia, for example, we're making sure that the integrity of that stays there, that it's open source from the beginning, that it's built on a foundation that's really solid, that's also going to be very difficult to compromise in the future by making it built on top of a decentralized open protocol as well. So we're doing things very slowly and making sure that when it's done, it's kind of like nice, polished, finished, and there as a solid foundation for other software to be built on top of. Now, when other people start using our solid foundation, they can build CRUD on top of it, you know, and we can't stop them from doing that.
Yeah.
But at least the foundation should be solid. It's a direct project goal of ours to avoid that as the inshittification as much as possible.
And I think there is something built into what you're building with Chelonia that, you know, kind of is a big roadblock to that inshittification cycle, right? Because I think part of one of the important steps that happens is, you know, first, your users are the most important people in the world, and then it becomes about your investors. So that means you start selling your users, essentially. And how do you sell your users? You spy on them, you steal their data, and you give that to somebody else.
Well, yeah, like we talked about last time, Chelonia is all about protecting user data. So we're not going to be able to sell their user data. Like we're literally not going to, we don't have the data to sell to begin with. So that's not going to be an open road for us to go down. So we're going to be creating the way that software that's built on Chelonia will work is it will be a lot more straightforward. You will simply pay for the cost of hosting data and that's it.
And I think that's something that I think about all of the free stuff that we get out there. Like you said, you know, it's free, but we kind of like pay a price for it. We pay with our data, or we, you know, you're always paying somehow. And sometimes I just, you know, I go, you know, this is a great service, but I wish I could just pay with money instead of data. But increasingly now it feels like you pay for software, but you're also having to sign some crazy thing that says you're going to give away your data. I don't know if you heard about the most recent Adobe terms of service.
No, I haven't.
The most recent Adobe terms of service give Adobe the right to watch you work and to look at the assets that you have that you load into Adobe so that it can use your work and your assets to train its AI to do your job. So, and you're paying, you pay like $700 or $800 a year for the right to have them come in and steal your data and your work from you.
Yeah. I mean, those are decisions that companies make, and really it's up to users to decide whether they're going to put up with that or not. There's, you know, hundreds of alternatives to Adobe products out there. Many of them are built out in the open as part of open source projects. GIMP is an excellent one. Inkscape is another one. Krita is another one. There's a whole bunch of them. So if people are tired of these kinds of manipulative tactics, there's always alternatives that they're more than welcome to support.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges here is kind of getting to people to care about this. I was at the bar with my friend the other night, and we were talking about data security and kind of how we give away our data. And he said something like, well, you know, I guess they have my data, and so why should I care? So I guess that's the question I'm going to put to you, Greg. You know, for people who maybe haven't thought about their data a lot, why should I care? Like, how is my data going to possibly be used against me? Or what's the problem with, you know, just letting my data be harvested?
So I was just listening to a podcast about this question where there are data brokers who collect all of this information, and they have information on all Americans. And there was this hacker from Vietnam who hacked into one of these companies. And normally these companies, you know, somewhat restrict who can access this data, but he was able to grab all of their data and actually use it as a paying customer of this company and then resell it unbeknownst to the company to anyone who wanted it. So he was making a lot of money reselling all of this information to criminals. And then these criminals can use your personal information to take out credit cards, for example, and then buy stuff with that and ruin your credit score and, you know, hopefully not social credit score in the future. But that, you know, if any social credit system is created, then that is another avenue for criminals to use kind of to basically steal people's identity and for their social credit, you know.
What is social credit?
So social credit systems are is perhaps most prominently well known as the system that's currently used in China, but there are interests, especially with things like digital ID, potentially to introduce this into other countries as well. And there's a big debate about this going on right now, with a lot of people saying that this is a horrible idea. With a credit score in the United States, what people are familiar with, that's basically like how trustworthy are you for taking out a loan? Mm-hmm. But with social credit, it's whatever the government decides is good. Basically, whatever the government decides is good behavior, the correct opinion. Basically, if you hold the correct opinion, if you have the correct points of view, if you do the right things, if you buy the right stuff, basically, if you do what the government says, your social credit is high. And if you do the opposite, it's going to be low. So it's a way of managing and controlling all of society from, you know, behind a laptop, basically.
Yikes. You know, I think there's, you know, it's already kind of bad enough that all my actions seem to be recorded. And if I say anything online, it's kind of like there forever. But at least I'm being judged by just like other people. You know, it's like mob judgment or something. But I somehow prefer that to just some person who happens to be part of the government who I didn't vote for is just going to decide if I'm an acceptable member of society. That sounds pretty scary.
It is very scary. Yeah. Because if your social credit goes down in this type of society, then as we see in China, you start losing access to various different services. You might not be able to buy a train ticket. You might not be able to buy a plane ticket. You might not be able to, you know, use the internet. You might not be, the sky's the limit, basically, on how totalitarian these kind of systems can get.
That is downright dystopian.
Yeah.
Wow. And there's real efforts to try and import that here to make that happen in the US?
Yes, yes. This is basically what is being called the combination of digital ID with something called CBDCs.
What's CBDC?
Yeah, I should probably define that. CBDCs stands for Central Bank Digital Currencies. Mm-hmm. So it's basically banking as we have it today, but on steroids. It's where all transactions happen on a ledger that's managed by the bank and fully controlled by the bank. And not just the transactions, but also the money printing happens on the same ledger. And the whatever entity controls this ledger has access and ability to restrict any transaction that happens on it. And by combining identity, digital ID, with this type of ledger, they can, and then a social credit system, they can say, oh, this person is making these purchases and they have this social credit score. And now, you know, if their social credit score gets too low, we can restrict what kind of purchases they're allowed to make. We can also restrict how much money they're allowed to spend. We can also restrict who they're allowed to send this money to, and so on and so forth. It's very, very granular level control over your life, basically. That's what digital ID, CBDCs, and social credit, this kind of a control grid is another term that's used to refer to the system.
I think that thinking about those possibilities is important because we live in the present and we have paths to choose in the future, right? What is our alternative to living in this world with digital ID and like the single ledger being used to exert a crazy amount of control over your life?
You're absolutely right. There are like these two roads that society can go down, and that every individual in society is being faced with this choice is whether or not they, you know, bow down to this digital control grid system, or whether or not they decide to finally look in a different direction and explore and use alternative technologies that don't do this type of stuff. So the alternatives to this are, I would say there would be two big alternatives, and they're kind of harmonious in a way. One is cryptocurrencies, and then the other is alternative platforms and alternative technologies to big tech. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me like much of big tech is getting hijacked by the same entities that are interested in implementing this control grid system. And so if that is the case, then they kind of will be working in concert together. So what you want to do is you want to fix both the money and also the tech platforms as well, and kind of do that together, because it's going to be either big tech and the control grid, or it's going to be alternative tech and cryptocurrency. That's kind of the two paths that I see things going down. So not all cryptocurrencies are created the same. Mm-hmm. And the term cryptocurrency has received a somewhat negative reputation in recent times because of, well, half, I think, is because of propaganda, just pure propaganda. And then the other half is because of real actual scams that happen on these systems.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to downplay any of that. And I will certainly acknowledge that you should stay away from cryptocurrency scams. And this requires a kind of education on the part of users as well. But it's a necessary type of education if they want to escape the CBDC control grid world. They have to find the legitimate cryptocurrencies and projects that are out there that care about their privacy, are taking concrete, innovative steps to protect their privacy, and then actually use these alternative currencies to create an alternative economy that works with an alternative tech system as well. That provides the same services that this one currently is providing.
So I think cryptocurrency, I think you're right. There is like kind of a lot of bad reputation out there for cryptocurrency. I think when people hear about cryptocurrency, they probably, a few things probably come to their mind is, like you mentioned, the scams, the meme coins, I think a lot of people like look at a cryptocurrency person, they're like, oh, it's somebody who, you know, is basically just day trading on crypto. They're trying to buy big and sell all the time. And it's all like Lambo hodl gang, like that kind of thing. Right. But what is it, like, why is it crucial for us to transition to cryptocurrencies? And then, like, how do I just, like, as an individual who knows basically only what I've heard about crypto so far in the mass media, how do I take my first step towards it?
Well, that's also a great question. And I think one of the first steps is to not get your crypto information from mass media, is to get it from better, more informed sources and inform yourself better about these different systems and look into, you know, more reputable cryptocurrencies that have been around for a long time, that have developers who are focusing on privacy technologies as well, who are talking about privacy and who are talking about protecting the privacy of their users. Because if they're not talking about that stuff, then, you know, I would consider that to be a red flag in a sense. Because if a cryptocurrency doesn't have a way of protecting the privacy of their users, then it can still be manipulated by this social credit system because their transactions can be traced and tracked and all this other stuff. So that's one thing that I recommend that users do is look for cryptocurrencies that are focusing on privacy, that have been around for a while and have a strong reputation in the space.
Are there any examples you can give us? Any recommendations from you?
Sure. I am not, okay. The following, of course, is not investment advice. So please do your own research, yeah. But some of the cryptocurrencies that I consider to be fairly reputable and who are kind of going down the right path are, of course, Bitcoin. And especially when Bitcoin is used through the Lightning Network, because the Lightning Network adds a layer of privacy on top of Bitcoin that Bitcoin by itself doesn't have. The Lightning Network it's a second layer above Bitcoin that allows transactions to happen much more quickly and much more cheaply. So, yeah, and there are some trade-offs there as well. So, for example, it's a little bit more difficult to use the Lightning Network between two peers when one peer is offline. Mm-hmm. But if it's between users and like a business, there's no problem there. So, and those transactions are fairly private. Then there is another one. Then there are two privacy coins that kind of compete with one another. One is called Monero, and another one is called Zcash. Those two have been around for a while, and they are also competing in this privacy space. There are also new privacy-focused projects that are being built on top of Ethereum, but those are still rather new and not really well-developed. But I would watch that space because the Ethereum Foundation has recently put a lot of energy and effort into improving the privacy of the Ethereum network.
And then you mentioned also just education on cryptocurrency. Where would you go just to learn more? Like what's the first stop I should go to?
I would say that if people want to learn more about cryptocurrencies from reputable sources, there are websites that are dedicated to these topics. There are podcasts that are dedicated to these topics. So for example, like Bitcoin Magazine is a fairly well-known website that covers Bitcoin-related news. There are cryptocurrency-focused podcasts that are great to listen to as well. Those would probably be some of the highest quality sources to go to. Then lower down on the tier would be something like YouTube. One of the problems with YouTube is that sometimes high quality information is censored, as we found out recently with our own podcast on YouTube being somewhat censored. We can get into that later if you'd like.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, YouTube is a maybe. And then there is also social networks such as X and more decentralized social networks like the Fediverse. So that would be things like Mastodon, Pleroma, or Nostr. Nostr is a big hub of Lightning-related activity. It's a social network that is more decentralized, is extremely censorship-resistant, and has integration for Lightning payments so that people can tip one another for the brilliant tweets that they put out.
What are the big barriers to adopting cryptocurrency more broadly? I think one you mentioned is like this education piece or this, there's the cultural kind of acceptance, right? But what about institutional acceptance or what other barriers do you see?
So I would say that one of the biggest barriers to broader adoption of cryptocurrencies has to be governments. Mm. And there are governments who are coming on board with the, you know, the cryptocurrency road. So one of the best well-known ones is El Salvador. And my recommendation to all governments who are interested in considering this path is to, one, embrace cryptocurrency, and two, tax it at point of sale. So that, I think, would be a great way to simplify taxes. It would also be a great way to guarantee a revenue stream for governments through taxing cryptocurrency transactions while protecting the privacy of all of their citizens as well. Mm. So taxing cryptocurrency transactions at point of sale is my recommendation.
How does the cryptocurrency community feel about that? Is that a controversial take, or is that kind of what people want to happen?
Well, to be honest, the cryptocurrency community isn't talking about this question much.
Really?
Yeah. No, because they've kind of been positioning themselves as, like, you know, anti-government and whatnot. Uh-huh. But, you know, the reality of the fact is that they were not going to be able to maintain that position for very long, because those are, you know, we have these two roads that we're going down, and the cryptocurrency community cannot say on the one hand that they want to become mainstream and on the other hand be anti-government. That's just like, those are two opposite desires. So if you want to be mainstream, you're going to have to actually work with governments to be mainstream. And so I think that the cryptocurrency community needs to start having these conversations.
Is investing in cryptocurrency the goal? Is it meant for, is it literally meant so that you can, like, buy milk? You know, what is cryptocurrency out there for?
Okay. So let's go, you know, back to basics, basically.
Yes,
why should anyone buy cryptocurrency to begin with? Yeah. Because a lot of people are also confused about this. So for example, you know, there's this confusion with, like, Bitcoin. Do you buy it and hold it, or do you buy it and spend it? You know, that is a confusion that people have. And actually, the answer is both. You buy it and hold it, and you buy it and spend it, both. Because if everyone were to simply buy Bitcoin and hold it and not spend it, then the value of their holdings would go down.
Mm-hmm.
And the value of their holdings would go down because the currency isn't being used at all. It's just there as a speculative instrument. And it's viewed almost as a way of being an intermediary for obtaining more of some other currency, right?
Yeah.
Like dollars or something. But that's, like, people really need to switch how they think about this whole thing, because Bitcoin is not about obtaining more dollars. No. Dollars are about obtaining more Bitcoin, right? That's how they need to think about it. And the Bitcoin is kind of like a global savings account. So banks offer their customers savings accounts. But this is false advertising, because those savings accounts don't actually help their customers. I honestly don't know if this is going to get me banned again or censored or whatever.
Yeah.
Already censored.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm really sorry to have to, you know, point out the obvious, but bank savings accounts are not savings accounts. They are more properly termed losings accounts. If you put your money into a bank savings account, that money is going to lose value over time at most of the interest rates that they offer to most of their customers because of inflation, because of money printing. They're not giving enough interest to their customers to compensate for the effects of inflation. So they're still losing money when that money is sitting there. Whereas a cryptocurrency that has a fixed cap on the supply that is in high demand, that is actually being used, that is a much more stable, robust system that can actually act as a savings account. Because what people do is they buy some of that currency, they hold on to it, the value of it goes up over time, maybe it goes down a little bit, but overall the trajectory is upwards. And they then spend whenever they need to spend it on, you know, day-to-day goods and services. But while they're saving, while they're holding on to it, if everyone is behaving in the same way, then it acts as a community savings account, basically.
It's still, like, I think that there's a lot of fear around cryptocurrency, because I think what a lot of people hear is, like, buying a cryptocurrency and it crashes and suddenly I've lost a bunch of money. And I know, again, you're not trying to give me investment advice, but is that an accurate picture of of what buying cryptocurrency looks like?
It depends on the cryptocurrency. Yeah. It depends on the market conditions. And because, for example, that was certainly true it certainly remains true for very volatile cryptocurrencies. And these are cryptocurrencies that basically have a smaller pool of users, mm-hmm. and a smaller market cap. They can have greater volatility, greater ups and greater downs. But cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, for example, over time, they should have greater and greater stability. Mm-hmm. If more users end up using them.
Yeah.
Because then the market cap of that goes higher, there's greater liquidity, and then it becomes harder and harder to throw the price very high upwards or very high downwards. And so it should kind of end up leveling off a little bit in terms of volatility. And that is true. If you look at the price of Bitcoin over time, it seems to be getting less volatile compared to its early days. Now, there could still be a lot of volatility, of course, but this volatility could end up getting less and less over time if more people are using this and if there's greater liquidity, because there's simply, you know, for every person who has a lot of money to buy a whole bunch of it, there will be another person who has a lot of money to sell a lot of it. And then the prices will kind of equalize.
Mm-hmm.
So let me add to that it can also be the case that there is volatility in the native currency of your country that you're using.
I was just thinking that, yeah. I was like, it's not like the dollar is
right.
completely stable.
Exactly.
Right?
So when people point to Bitcoin and they say, oh, look at how volatile it is or it can be or whatever. Well, you can also point to other currencies such as the dollar, such as the dollar equivalents in other countries, whatever their native government's currency is. Many times throughout those governments' history, they can also see great volatility in the value of their national currency as well. So that can happen. So just because you're saving and holding on to dollars or saving and holding on to pesos or saving and holding on to yuan or whatever the case may be, it's not necessarily going to be true that, that the value of that currency will remain stable. And the way that that shows up is that you go to the market one day and you see that the price of milk is $2. And then you go to the market the next day and you see that the price of milk is $5. Well, what just happened? The price of your dollar went crazy like this. Mm-hmm. The volatility, was in comparison to some other currency was significant.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about governments adopting cryptocurrencies. And I think my first question is like, okay, if we've decided we, the people, want governments to adopt cryptocurrencies, awesome. But why would governments actually want to do this?
So governments who do not want to be manipulated by other entities that are outside of them, who want greater control over their own destinies, over the destinies of their government and the destinies of their people, if they don't want to outsource that to some outside entity, they would certainly want to consider cryptocurrencies because this will give them more control over their own country's finances. Because many times, for example, when governments get loans, for example, from the World Bank or the IMF or whatever, a lot of these loans may come with different conditions, whether written or maybe even unwritten conditions. And then if governments are okay with those conditions, then, they might say, okay, well, we'll stick with that traditional system. But if they want more control over their own destinies, then cryptocurrency offers them that path.
You talked about taxing crypto as the way governments do this, but what would it actually look like, for example, for the US government to adopt cryptocurrency and accept it? Would it be like, we don't print dollars anymore, we're just Bitcoin now? What would that actually be like?
Well, it could look like there could be different forms that it could take. So, one hypothetical way that this could appear is the government could make it easier and maybe they could work a little bit with some cryptocurrency companies or make pass executive orders or, you know, rules, or make also change the tax code a little bit to make it more friendly to cryptocurrencies so that they're, you know, you're not constantly taxed on capital gains for every, like when you buy a can of soda, right? Like that seems a little bit obnoxious. So
is that what's happening now?
Yeah. It is effectively, cryptocurrencies are treated kind of like commodities, and they're taxed on with capital gains. And it would be much better to treat the cryptocurrencies as currencies. You know, it's in the name.
It's in the name. Yeah.
It's in the name. Yeah. So that when they when a person goes to buy a can of soda, the government gets some of that, some of the cost of that soda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it would look is, you know, this the vending machine would be working with some company that would be collecting these payments, and it would be sending a portion of those payments back to the government as sales tax, basically. And you could honestly get rid of all of the complicated income tax and all this other stuff that, you know, people in society puts a lot of energy and stress into, and just run a government on sales tax alone. So some people object to this and say, oh, it's regressive or whatever. But it really isn't if it's percentage based and if it's applied very broadly, you know, because then whether somebody is making small purchases or very large purchases, they are taxed on a percentage of that, you know, not a fixed amount, but a percentage of that, a purchase, and that percentage is going to the government. So if somebody buys a yacht, right, with and then they're going to pay a percentage in sales tax, and that's a fairly sizable chunk that will end up going to the government. And I think that everybody, it's kind of a win-win situation for everybody, because taxes get simplified, people don't have to stress about them so much, people's privacy is preserved, and the government can continue operating as a government and has a source of funding.
We all probably have this vague idea of cryptocurrency. It's a non-government currency. It's on the internet. A lot of people use it to speculate. But what really is the difference between a cryptocurrency and like the US dollar?
I kind of want to approach it from the perspective of this fork in the road that we've been talking about, mm-hmm. because the US dollar is, you know, if we continue down this path with digital ID and CBDCs and all of this other stuff, the definition of a US dollar is going to become that, basically. It's going to become something along those lines where it is a currency that's used as a means of controlling your every thought, basically, a means of controlling your behavior. And whereas cryptocurrency would be just a cryptocurrency. So cryptocurrency would be more like what we currently think of as dollars and as cash. And the dollar would become this this control grid mechanism.
And I mean, in many ways, too, it's like it already is that, right? You know, like our money is kind of trapped within a system that's made to generate profits for other people, right? Like every time I put my paycheck into the bank, I put it in my savings account, right? And what's happening with that money that's sitting in my savings account?
Well, I mean, in the sense that banks are using it to speculate, perhaps, you know, that could be the case. But in here, I want to push back a little and say that cryptocurrency, you know, of course, would still also be a mechanism for individuals and companies to generate profits as well.
Sure.
And, you know, that's fine. That's what currencies are for. They're for, you know, buying goods and services. And I'd like for them to remain that and not become something that they shouldn't be.
When we were talking about cryptocurrency scams, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, those stories get a lot of coverage, but is there any big cryptocurrency scam that we could talk about, some scam currency? And I just want to do it from the perspective of how is that currency maybe different from something like Ethereum or Bitcoin?
Sure. I'm not going to, you know, I honestly don't give these scams enough room in my brain take up storage space so that I remember their names, to be honest. Like, but there are many, you know, especially many meme coins and whatnot that are out there. Like most meme coins are scams. They're speculative instruments. They're pump and dump schemes.
Mm-hmm. What's pump and dump?
It's very simple. It's where somebody, like a group of characters, buys up the currency, you know, at time, you know, zero, And then they're raising the price of that currency through their buying of it because they're the only ones who are even aware that this currency exists. And then they start like being like, oh, look at the price of this, you know, amazing frog token or whatever. Look at how it's going. It's going to the moon. And then they start spamming the social networks with this nonsense. And then other people start buying this token and think, I'm going to get rich and get my Lambo or whatever. And then the people who bought it earlier start selling it at that point in time while they're being like, going to the moon. And then, you know, that's the dumping part. And then the price crashes and the people who bought it up at the top are in tears. And I lost, you know, whatever. I'm not going to get my Lambo. So that's a pump and dump scam.
Okay. So maybe a red flag to look for is just if you see maybe too much of this currency appearing on your social media, maybe be suspicious.
Well, it's not even just that it like suddenly appears on your social media. It's what is the thing actually doing? Uh-huh. Is it providing some kind of a useful functionality, something innovative, something that hasn't been done before, some kind of useful feature that's unique to it? Does the person who created it, you know, are they a real person? Did they have a history of making scams? Are they, did they have a long-term vision for where they want to take this thing and why it's actually worth purchasing? You know, look into all of those questions and investigate these for yourself. And so, for example, the reason why I wouldn't call Ethereum a scam is because the Ethereum community, or Bitcoin for that matter, is because these are current cryptocurrencies that were founded by groups and individuals who had a long-term vision of utility. So when Bitcoin first came out, for example, you know, a lot of people called it a scam, but those people were wrong. Why were they wrong? Why were they mistaken? They were mistaken because they didn't understand that Bitcoin was doing something extraordinarily valuable that nobody else was doing, something that society actually needed. And that's what they missed, is that there was real actual value there. And this was like, they were in this for the long haul. They had a long-term vision of what they wanted to accomplish. And now they're competing against the global financial system, which is like huge, right? So that's like a big deal. And that's why they're part of this path to avoid the control grid. That's immensely valuable. It's our only option to deal with this control grid. So that has intrinsic value for that sense. You know, people say Bitcoin doesn't have intrinsic value. Well, I think they're very clearly mistaken about that, because to me, this is intrinsic value. My freedom is an intrinsic value, right? And that's what Bitcoin is offering me. That's what all of these other cryptocurrencies that are focusing on privacy are offering to people. It's very intrinsically valuable.
And I assume that you still have to interact with that global financial system. You still have U.S. dollars and everything, right? Mm-hmm. And I think most of us do. The thing is, we can't buy everything we want to with cryptocurrency right now. And so if I'm like, tomorrow I need to open a bank account, I'm probably going to have to go to an established bank and put some U.S. dollars in there, or put some Canadian dollars or euros or you know, whatever my currency is. Is there anything I should beware of when approaching a bank or the traditional financial system? Is there anything I can do to protect myself?
And so one of the things that I ran into when just simply trying to open a bank account is that these, even with online banks, is that these online banks will shut down your account if you use an online phone number. That seems a little bit odd.
If I have a Google Voice number
Or a VoIP number, and these types of phone numbers are very useful for protecting people's privacy, because if you have somebody's phone number, though, that phone number can be sold through various data brokers as well as the black market, and those phone numbers can also be used to track the actual physical location of people.
Really?
Yes. So like if you just go around handing out your phone number to various different people, they can, using that number, figure out where you are and what you're doing. So this is why VoIP numbers are very useful. And if, you know, people care about their privacy, I recommend that they actually get a VoIP number. Now, if they try to open up a bank account with a VoIP number, they might run into some problems, because apparently there was some guidance or whatever that, at least in the United States, that told banks not to accept these phone numbers, possibly because of fraud or whatnot that's could be associated with them. But I think that guidance was removed. So banks aren't legally obligated to do this, but some of them do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have to shop around. I eventually found a bank that accepted a VoIP number, and, you know, you may just have to try a few different ones. Yeah,
that's a good piece of advice too, is finding an online phone number instead of giving out your personal number to strangers.
Yes, that's right. And some of these banks also don't just want your personal phone number, but they want so much more information about you as well. They want your biometric data. They want your photo. They want your driver's license. They want this and that. And not all of them need to collect all of the information that they're collecting. Not only that, but sometimes these banks will also work with third parties, and they will have the third party collect your information. So now it's not, when you want to open a bank account, it's not just the bank account that has your information, but now it's this other company that has your information as well. So this is two companies that have your information, and most likely one of them or both are selling your information to other companies as well. So when you give all this private information out to these banks, you're basically giving your information out to criminals, because eventually it ends up in their hands as well. So this is one reason why people may want to avoid the use of the existing financial system entirely as well and consider cryptocurrencies. But unfortunately, many people, to obtain cryptocurrencies in the first place, they have, you know, their dollars or whatever that they want to convert into cryptocurrencies. So they end up jumping through these hoops. And, you know, if there are people who want to obtain cryptocurrencies, you know, just by selling, for example, goods and services, that's one way that you could actually get cryptocurrencies, is you could take whatever service you're offering. You know, you may have a business, a small business, a big business, and just offer the option of paying for your service in terms of cryptocurrencies. That's another way that you could obtain cryptocurrencies that avoids all of this mess of, you know, destroying your privacy.
You talked about giving your information to a third party. You actually had a personal experience where a bank asked you to share information with a third party. Can you just tell me what happened there?
Yeah, they wanted me to upload all of these documents, and they were sending me to this other company. And I looked into the company, and I was like, this seems, you know, a little bit questionable. I just said no, cancel. And then they offered me the option to send it to them, to the bank directly. I was like, oh, well, you should have offered me that option to begin with. You know, I'd rather just give you directly these this documentation. So that's something that you might find with banks, is just by using your own discernment and saying no when something feels off, the bank may actually offer you a better option. But you can also just shop around. And these days, it's a lot easier to do that, because you can ask, for example, an LLM, can you tell me some of the different banks that, you know, either care more about or that have a good reputation in terms of privacy? Or can you just list some of them and, you know, get a list and then spend an evening applying for accounts with all of them and seeing which one respects your privacy the most? With tech, the devil's in the details. People need to know that for whatever dystopia they're offering you, there's usually a much better way of doing that very same thing.